Wow, there's such a lovely noise in the room this morning. Good morning, good morning. My name is Becky Metcalf, and on behalf of Design Centre Chelsea Harbour, a very, very warm welcome to Focus. This is our first session of our Conversations in Design series. As you can see, we're in a new venue, which is beautifully painted with lots of colour, because colour is such a strong theme for the show. And we've got a real treat in store today, an international panel of experts. So pin back your ears, because there's going to be lots to talk about. A bit of housekeeping first. If I could ask everybody just to turn off their phones, that would be really kind. Now, we're absolutely delighted that this session is being hosted by Homes and Gardens. It's actually one of the, I think it is the oldest magazine in the UK, but I also feel it's the most current. And next year, it's celebrating 100 years, which is no mean feat. We're absolutely thrilled that Sarah Spiteri, the editorial director, is chairing the session. So please give her and our wondrous panelists a very, very warm welcome.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Design Centre Chelsea Harbour. As Becky said, my name is Sarah Spiteri, and I'm the editorial director of Homes and Gardens. It's an absolute honour to kick off Design Week and Focus to be here, and I just want to thank Becky and Anna and all the Design Centre team for hosting these conversations. They're a total pleasure to take part in and also to attend. It's also an honour to sit alongside such a star-studded panel who are here today to discuss all things design, from interior style and the differences between British and American aesthetics to creating the perfect space. All of the panellists bring a unique viewpoint to the discussion. As you'll start to see, there'll be some rolling images on the screens, and you'll start to see sort of how each creative has a very different look. And in just a moment, I'll give you an overview of their career history to date. But just in case you haven't attended one of these talks before, the format is we'll talk for about 45 minutes, and then we'll throw it over to you guys for any questions. You can direct them at everybody or a specific person, you know, as you feel. So starting with Timothy, he's one of the world's leading interior designers with offices in both LA and Paris. His firm has completed projects in Europe, the Middle East, and the United States. His work has featured in over 1,000 publications worldwide, so I'm told, and has earned him the Design Icon Award, the Star of Design, Legacy Award, and spots on AD 100, El Deco A-List, etc., etc. He is the only American designer to be honoured by the French Heritage Society for his restoration of several national landmarks in France. And he has also designed licensed collections for Schumacher, Royal Limoges, THG Paris, Fremantle, and most recently Samuel & Sons. Architect Claire set up her practice de Rosset Saar with Max de Rosset in 2007. Based in Notting Hill, the firm holds a reputation for designing imaginative and well-considered schemes spanning residential, commercial, educational sectors, and retail. Prior to setting up the business, Claire was senior associate at John McCaslin & Partners and also worked in New York for Eisenman Architects and Massana O'Rourke Architects. Claire completed her studies at the Architectural Association, having gone to Edinburgh University. And last but by no means least, Adam Bray is an interior decorator born, raised, and based in London with more than 25 years of experience. His antique dealing background has given him a unique perspective and allows him to design comfortable rooms that are luxurious, eclectic, and unpretentious. He is known for his distinctive palette of colour, use of antique and mid-century furniture, vintage carpets, and beautiful textiles. He's worked extensively in London and the English countryside, but also designed an incredible six-year project on a large house outside of Marrakesh. He has collaborated with Plain English Design on two collections of paint and recently launched a collection of carpets with Vanderherd. So, over to the panel, really. I thought it'd be good to start with our sort of core transatlantic question, and I wondered if, Claire, you wanted to kickstart our discussion, having worked both in New York and in London as an architect. What insight can you share on the differences between the two design scenes?
Well, I think we mentioned briefly before when we were having a chat that actually I think perhaps the difference between the way people were designing in New York and in London, you know, 10 or 20 years ago may have been a little bit more extreme, but these days with, you know, Instagram and people, you know, being fed so much visual stimuli that people are, certainly in London, I think a lot more sort of sophisticated and looking for sophisticated looks in terms of what they're designing.
International.
I mean, we have clients who sort of want a Parisian sort of chic kind of look in, you know, in their apartments, and you know, a lot of sort of feel for textures and materiality. And I don't think I really don't feel that there's such a sort of you know New York or American look these days and a London look. I think people are just becoming more sort of educated and aware, you know, when it comes to design, and they actually sort of, you know, new clients approach you already with fairly well formed aesthetics or looks that they're wanting to achieve, and it's not necessarily just because they're working on a Victorian or Georgian house that's the sort of look they want to you know, paste on top of the sort of backdrop that they've already got.
Yeah, so. Timothy, you've got your office in Paris, so does that bring another sort of...
What I find interesting is that actually I find that Americans tend to be a little more concerned with making things match, making things, if that's the rug, then this is what the fabric needs to be or whatever. Whereas I find that internationally, people are a little more open to mixing, a little bit more open to taking some chances. And it's difficult to say something is an American look, because I think there really are different... America is so big, you know, that what someone likes in Atlanta is going to be totally different than what they like in Dallas, than what they like in Los Angeles or New York. So there really is no particular American look, I would say. But increasingly, I would agree with you totally, with media being what it is, people are seeing looks from all over the world. So people literally are sort of saying, well, I want that, I want that, I want that. And it's not so exclusively one country's specific look. Wouldn't you agree, Adam, on that?
Yes. I mean, and also I think in terms of an industry, I think in this country I'm finding far more people from all sort of walks of life and all sort of income brackets are thinking about getting a decorator in, whereas certainly in my experience in New York 20, 30 years ago, a one-bedroom apartment for a lawyer, he'd have a decorator, she'd have a decorator. It would be a much more professional sort of process, whereas here, as I was saying earlier, you know, you go into someone's house 20 years ago to look at a project, and it was really just a concern about, you know, where the dogs would sit and whether you could get the Marmite off the sofa. Right. You know, so I think we've become much more international in this country, just purely in terms of the people who've come to live here for the time being. And
do you think that's the same in London? Influence. Do you feel that there's a London bubble, and once you do your projects in the countryside, there's a different design aesthetic, or is that...
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And it's a totally different... The fabrics, the feeling, the mood, everything is completely different. Because the use is completely different.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that, because I was at a country house last summer, and here in outside of London, and it had been one of the last houses that John Fowler had designed, and the new owners literally redid it, and it was entirely gray. It was entirely beige, you know, sort of... And she sort of, the wife said, I really sort of regret having done this, because my friends refer to this house now as the 40 Shades of Grey house. It's just because she had ripped out everything and really sort of wholesale taken in what was sort of the fashion for developers, frankly,
yeah.
And put it into this wonderful little country house. And I think that that's what's sad, is when you see something that might have been appropriate for a London flat and applying it, yeah, you know, all the way on a big, wonderful country house.
But I think, as Adam says, it's that people actually appreciate it. You're not just fixing your house with what is necessary, now that people realize that actually to sort of have a sort of decorator or an interior designer or even an architect is just adds masses of sort of value to what you're doing, and it's a necessity. I mean,
and I'm interested with what you say with people coming with quite a developed look to you. Do you find that with your kind of, when you're working, people are coming with a mood board now, as opposed to sort of saying, you know, over to you, what's the latest look in fabrics?
I think people really do have a sense. I mean, I've had clients who literally have come to me because of a single room, and they've said, those curtains, I want those curtains. That's the what I want through my entire house. Mm. So I think that they really are, they're coming to you with a specific thing that you
the
are
The challenge sometimes for us is just editing that look, because sometimes they'll be like, you know, we're actually doing a new build where the client's gone, well, I quite want this to look quite Georgian, and then I want this to look sort of, you know, New York, kind of smart. Yeah. And that's just sort of curating the whole thing so that they don't end up with a sort of Disney pastiche of a lot of things. Because people, you know, they pin stuff or they Instagram stuff and they like it all. And then you sort of have to manage that
and edit it.
And sometimes actually go, this house you've bought, this just doesn't work for what you know, this look, you've got to, you know, we've got to rethink this. And then that, sometimes you have to, it takes them a few months to sort of get it out of their system and, you know, almost learn a new kind of approach to it.
Yes, and I think that's very true. Where we were recently approached by some clients who wanted, they showed us some rooms from a place in Paris, and, you know, they were 18, 20-foot ceilings, and I said, but you've got 10-foot ceilings. You will never achieve this look. So perhaps we should need to look at something that's going to be more attainable with what you're actually dealing with.
Yeah, I often get shown sort of vast, you know, American country kitchens, huge, great things for tiny flats in Battersea. And it's like, you know, it could. The idea is marvelous, but you would have to buy the flat next door to have somewhere to sleep. You know, you go through phases of things. I went through a period of seeing, because I asked people to show me what they would like, you know, for our first sort of meetings. There are several things that I was seeing over the sewn bar cart. That over and over again, which is a lovely thing. And Erin Lauder's apartment on Park Avenue, which is done by Jacques Grange, which is wall-to-wall Picasso and Jean-Michel Franck, and amazing. And quite hard to, you know, in a Hackney townhouse to get that.
Yeah.
Quite that vibe, but, you know, you can try.
Yeah. You were mentioning earlier about art as well, and how that kind of art influences so much a mood of a space, and how if you can go very strongly down a look, but if you haven't got that sort of finishing layer, it's hard to then sort of really succeed. And I think that was an example of in New York.
Yeah. I mean, but also there's a picture here of somewhere of one of my projects, which was a house in Hackney for a girl who was in the fashion business, and she had some amazing pictures. And there's a library with this very modern picture by an up-and-coming painter, and it just made the whole room immediately make sense. And it was a question of really under-decorating so that picture meant something, you know, rather than...
Yeah, sometimes it's, you know, you will ask clients just to show us what art they really want, or, you know, some not necessarily always the furniture, but you're right, you can design a room around a good piece of artwork if it's got enough, you know, weight of its own.
We're doing a project at the moment where the client is shipping over a very big collection of black and white photographs, and we're plotting that out so that... Yeah. You've got it very clear.
But I think it's such a joy when you do have clients who have art and collections, because so many don't, and you have to really then educate them on the importance of that, even if it's not really good pictures, just the idea of the importance of what that does to help give depth and layering to a room by having that element of art on the walls.
And how different, say with your LA and Paris, how different are the practices that you run there? Are you able to have the Timothy Corrigan look and that thread runs through, or do you have to amend that to suit those different markets?
No, I think we really, I purposely, when I started the business, decided that I wanted to stay small enough that I was personally involved in absolutely every project. So I think that, fortunately, unfortunately, that's a curse and a blessing. So I think that we really are able to maintain consistency across all projects, because I really am intimately involved. I think the designers would sometimes, my designers would say I'm too intimately involved, but I really make the decision on anything before it gets presented to a client.
Yeah, and so obviously with that sort of transatlantic, I know we're talking about Paris, but, you know, thinking about homes and the aesthetic in LA is very different to the aesthetic we would have in Europe. And what's the thread in your work, do you think, that works in both of those areas?
This is going to sound crazy, because a lot of my rooms like this, they may not look comfortable at first glance. I'm doing a new book, and I said I wanted it to be called Comfortable Elegance, and the publishers said, well, but your rooms don't look very comfortable. And I said, but I promise you they are. They really, and it's one of those things that's difficult to communicate, but I would say that comfort is probably the key element that runs throughout, whether it's in a house like this, which is in Beverly Hills, or it's, we recently did a Belgravia house here in London, which was, again, it's, we've made it very comfortable. So I think that is that element. So it's that aspect of comfort.
That's big for you as well, isn't it,
Adam? Yeah, otherwise what's the point?
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be about comfort, and it has to be, at the very basis of planning it, it has to be about practicality and usefulness and purpose, comfort, and then everything else kind of enables that, really, rather than the, well, certainly for me, I think.
Yeah, but joy as well. I mean, yeah, when you walk into a room and go, you know, you know, this makes me feel good.
Yes,
or like,
yes.
This is so cozy, I want to sort of,
right.
You know,
well,
and that's kind of comfort.
I agree, but I think that comfort is also something that is more than just how something looks and feels. There's a peace of mind that comes when you walk in and you feel like, I can put my feet up, I can spill my coffee on this, whatever. I mean, we've been using performance and outdoor fabrics for as long as they've been around indoors, because it adds that layer of comfort. And I think that's what's so wonderful, is that there are so many great companies that do wonderful outdoor and performance fabrics that look and feel like the best indoor fabrics.
Yeah. And do you think color, in this sort of joyful piece, is color sort of really fundamental to that? Or can you achieve that with a more of a developer-y look, which is much simpler? Is color a key part of that story?
I think colour is so important, but I think it's, you know, light, the sort of, you know, you start with the natural light of what the room has, and colour. Like, for example, I'm always trying to sort of encourage clients to be a bit bolder with colour, because, you know, when they strip back and they start, you know, and they see the kind of white walls, it makes it sort of feel fresh and new and clean. And, you know, I try to sort of encourage people to do sort of make smaller rooms a bit darker, make bigger rooms a bit brighter. But I think colour is so important because, you know, certainly when we are building, you know, we go back to the steels or the concrete, but actually what you end up seeing when you walk into a room is the colour, and is the sort of what's immediately on the surface. And I think it's incredibly important. It sets the mood for a room. And there's definitely, I kind of see a lot more colour being thrown at projects. And people, you know, I guess, you know, there's a lot of brands now that are, you know, really paint brands that are, you know, pushing those ideas.
Well, when I looked at all of your images before the talk, I was really struck by how much colour was kind of coming through all the projects and across the whole spectrum, not, you know.
I think that's one of the things that people look to employ
designers,
people like us for, is doing things that they're not necessarily comfortable doing themselves and pushing that a little bit harder than they would necessarily go themselves with, you know.
Mm. Well, that's the joke that we always make with press, how, you know, the thing that we feature, the fabric that we photograph for our style shoots, probably isn't the fabric people end up buying from the retailer, because they walk into the store because they've seen the editorial and they're excited and enlivened by that, and then they buy the slightly safer version of it,
which
I suppose introducing the decorator is what pushes people to go for that more confident choice.
Right, and I think it's interesting because you can. I've got some projects here that are very light colored. We had a client who really wanted everything white, and I sort of said, you don't really want it all white. So we started introducing light blues and light greens and other colors that helped give that sort of total clean look that they wanted, but actually added some layers of depth that the color provides.
Mm. And then thinking about sort of the concept of glamour, because a lot of, well, what you all do feels quite glamorous. Does that come from, where do you think that kind of comes from? Is that from the layering, or is that from furniture, or what do you think is the sort of secret to that glamorous touch?
I think for me the sort of glamour is being able to juxtapose a sort of antique with you know, or an antique chair on a polished concrete floor with a Persian rug, just being able to put the things together so that it sort of looks a bit like I don't care, but it's all kind of beautifully composed. I think people kind of want to show their homes as well, especially when they're spending, you know, big sums of money. They want to. So I think it's just being able to sort of put things together, but also in a way that doesn't sort of have that kind of developer look that Timothy was sort of perhaps talking about. That looks sort of sophisticated. Mm.
And you obviously, with your antique dealing background, that's very sort of essential to what you do.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I use antiques because I want to have, I suppose, an element of soulfulness about a room. And I find that nothing really gives that like something old, you know, and something well-proportioned, something that's had a life, particularly even if you're restoring an old building and putting all the architecture back. I mean, I don't fill places with antiques. I'm tempted, I just feel it adds something. It adds personality and individuality, and it expresses the client in a way that something contemporary, even if we design it for the client, doesn't really. It's I think glamour's about the expression of the client who they really want to see themselves as.
I actually think that glamour comes through the details. Whether it's the architectural detailing that's there, whether it's in the piece of furniture, whether it's a fabric that has a detail that you actually don't see. You look at it, and you see a broad form, and then you get closer, and you see that there's all this other detailing. I think that the detailing is almost the ultimate luxury. And I think that you'll see it. It's the accumulation of details in a room that very subtly create a sense of glamour and elegance.
We are talking about trimmings, and you know, you've recently done your work with Samuel and Sons. Right. But sort of that level of detail, I think, is when you get that wonderfully finished, that when you are, you know, every sort of corner has a design touch.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it can be, and again, it doesn't have to be in a traditional setting. It can be in a very contemporary setting, but you can see that concern for the architectural detail or the detailing on the edge of the table or whatever it is there. And I think it's that's what subtly communicates glamour.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think a client who will go on that journey with you and will appreciate those details and will appreciate the fact that, you know, it's really important that the kind of coffee table has these, you know, brass legs that just float off the ground, whatever it is, if they understand the value of that sort of, you know, probably them and themselves, they're already sort of, you know, in terms of glamour, halfway there.
Yeah.
And then in terms of shopping, so Timothy, when you come to London, where are you looking to? What are you sort of... Where do you see the kind of heart of the kind of interior?
Well, I have to say, I actually love Chelsea Harbour Design Center. I was here 3 weeks ago, and I literally left a meeting early and said, I've got to get there before they close, because there are things that are available here that are not available other places. Mm. And so I actually always make a point of coming here. There are so many wonderful antique shops here. There's so much that London has to offer. So I think it's you're so lucky to be here and have all this right at your doorstep.
And do you feel, Claire, when you're doing projects in London, that they're even in sort of, we're talking about how in America every state is like a different country, and you know, if something that's right in Texas isn't right in New York. Is there a similar feel, you know, if you were doing a Notting Hill project as opposed to doing a Hackney or Peckham, or, you know, do you feel there's a similar kind of difference in styles, even when you move through a small area?
I think perhaps defined by the type of architecture or the buildings.
Right.
You know, and obviously in Notting Hill you get small kind of Victorian terraces, but you equally kind of get much larger kind of white stucco fronted houses that by their nature might have, you know, really high ceilings in the raised ground floors, that sort of thing. And maybe if you're going to Hackney, you may be kind of talking on a smaller scale. And I think that sort of sets, in some way, sets your brief. And as Adam was saying, you know, if you're doing a house in Hackney that has a kitchen that's 2x4, you know, a big arga is, you know, sort of inappropriate. So I think perhaps the architecture of the spaces, because the type of client who appreciates art or interiors in Notting Hill, and you know, you might have a similar type of client living in Hackney. I think London is, it's big, but it's also sort of fairly small. So I think perhaps the you know, the streets and the building, the architecture that
Claire was making
that.
The observation when we were chatting before the talk about it's not even a trend, it's the way that English people have their sort of lights on and curtains open to their kind of ground floor living rooms, sort of encouraging people to look in. And she grew up in Portugal, where it's sort of very kind of curtains closed. And there's that difference that you're designing for other people and you're creating rooms for hosting in and to sort of to show to other people. And I think that's kind of culturally, if we're thinking about what, you know, design means here and overseas, sort of comment there.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that in America we're much more open to showing what we have, sometimes to a fault. But I think it's what's interesting is to see that cultural difference. Again, in Paris, where I am a lot, you don't have it. It's much more closed. Yeah. It's much more, you know, like Portugal, as you would say. And it's funny because I actually never really noticed that about London, where it is all open and on display. And I don't know, do you think that's a new thing?
No, I think people just, you know, they may be...
Yeah.
I think people don't...
Yeah.
Yeah. If I walk around my neighbourhood at night, which is a densely residential neighbourhood in northwest London, I mean, I can tell the people in number 46, you know, making risotto, and the people in number 22 are having a fight while the children play, you know. So it's kind of like... it's a very English thing. But you never get invited. Well, I don't. I don't take it personally. You never get invited in. you just get to watch it from the outside while you're trying to find somewhere to park.
I think it's great, especially when you live in a city. I mean, I always think it's such fun to walk down the streets at night and just, you know, have a little snoop inside everybody's sort of city
room. Like real life Instagram.
Yeah, it's great fun. And look, those two houses are identical. Look what they've done. Look what they've done. And it's completely different.
Yes. No, but that's a very interesting point. The other day, I was wandering home from somewhere and I was looking in the window of an estate agent in Notting Hill. So many identical apartments, televisions above the fireplace.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, it was like extraordinary. And I just...
Well, with creative originality, do we think, do platforms like Instagram, Pinterest, do they enhance it? Do they dampen it? What do you think is the impact of that kind of lots of media, lots of sort of opportunity to see new things?
I think it's wonderful. I think it's a great opportunity to get to see a lot more. I was on a panel where a young designer said that he got all of his design inspiration from Instagram, and I sort of was shocked because I thought that felt very shallow because there's no depth, there's no context to Instagram. So I think it's great in terms of making you aware of things. I think it's a real pitfall if you rely on it and say that's going to be my source for creative inspiration. I think it's a great opportunity.
Like online dating, apparently. But I find Instagram incredibly helpful. I really enjoy being on it. I really love connecting with my friends and with the community at large. It's also extremely intimidating sometimes. I find myself thinking, really? That holiday? and you see very, very beautiful things. I buy a lot of antiques on Instagram.
Having seen them on there?
I use it as a tool.
Interesting.
It's really useful. Lots of great dealers who don't have shops, whose websites are not very well run, put things on Instagram. And there's a big, big antique dealing community on there.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful, it's so great to have inspiration. And Pinterest, we're always telling clients, just pin stuff on it. But I think our jobs as designers is to then really study it. Sometimes you've got to be fairly academic about looking at the interior of a room and going, why does this work? We know we like it, but what is it about it that works? And to be able to understand that and pinpoint it and in some way recreate it, that's hard. And that's, you know, people can pin or you know, kind of like, you know, I don't know, hundreds of things on Instagram, but unless you sort of understand, you know, if you just want to take your just sort of shop window, fine. But if you're trying to produce a project where you are actually trying to build something or recreate a look, then you've got to really understand what it is that you're looking at and why it works. Is it the colour? Is it the texture? Is it those old floorboards? Is it just the kind of big windows, the proportion? You know, all of those things. And that's, you know, I guess that's our job is to kind of make, you know.
Is that education Chancellor. Process?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I always think I've tried to be really academic about just looking at imagery. And then, you know, when you're going to see art or going into a room feeling the kind of, you know, is it quite echoey, is it hollowy? You know, as Timothy said, it can't be just the sort of 2D thing you're seeing on Instagram.
And I actually think it's one of our real responsibilities as designers for clients is to help educate them, help them understand why something is the way it is. And I find that when we do that, we'll give clients at the end of the project a whole book that explains where this table came from and why it was made and et cetera. And they're actually very proud of that. They liked having that sense of knowledge so that they can then say to their friends, well, this is like this because X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's it's an important part of what we do is to help them understand and grow.
Yeah. And you work a lot in France. You said are you on your fifth?
My fifth chateau, which means I'm a total glutton for punishment. But I just love restoring these great old buildings.
And so is it the restoration process that you love, or is it the spaces that you get?
France has such incredible historical richness in terms of old buildings, old chateau and houses and things like that. So I just love the detail, the architectural details, and then understanding their role in history, understanding who lived here and how they lived in that. And so it's that whole process of the restoration and then bringing it forward to today and how we live today, because every structure has to evolve. We did a project for a client, which was a 17th century monastery in Saint-Paul-de-Vence, and they wanted to make it into a house. And it was that challenge of taking these big, thick stone walls, which were basically the little monks' cells, basically, and turn them, figure out how to use that space. And I think that's the fun part of taking the architecture of another time and making it appropriate for today.
And then thinking back to America, then I suppose, obviously, the history that you get when you're working in Europe brings a very different...
Yes, because I mean, America is such a new country that our history is so short that oftentimes they'll say, oh, gee, that's a really historic house, and it's from 1923 or something. and so that's something. It's one of the reasons that I think I'm personally drawn to the history that you get here in Europe.
Mm. And what about, with the Middle East as well? You work there a bit as well.
Yes. And we've done a lot of work in the Middle East. And what's interesting there is... that they have such a recent history in terms of real wealth. But what's fascinating to see is the gradations even there of how they look at each other. I was doing a project in the Royal Palace in Qatar, and the emir came by, and we had some guilders from Paris there, and they were doing some gilding, and the first layer was very shiny, and the emir said, well, you're not going to leave it shiny like that, are you? And the gilder said, no, Your Highness, we're preparing it. And he said, oh, good. I wouldn't want anyone to think they were in Saudi Arabia. And again, it was just sort of that sense of what's popular here is not popular there. And it's fascinating to work, you know, in different cultures.
And Adam, you've been working in London for such a long time. Do you think that... I don't mean that in a... Do you feel that today, you know, looking back over that 25 years, do you feel that today is different and more energised, or is it peaks and troughs?
I mean, I think right now it's a very strange time.
Right.
There's a lot of stagnation in the market. It's very odd. But I'm getting asked to look at houses that people have lived in for 10 or 15 years to redo. You know, so they've lived there, they've raised their children there, and they're going to stay there. What can we do? So, you know, there's the practicality of that. And I think also, increasingly, I'm going to look at apartments that have been done by developers in big white buildings where what would have been a very sort of gracious two-bedroom or three-bedroom apartment has been made into a little six-bedroom kind of nightmare.
Yeah.
And nothing makes sense. And to try and get all of that, put all of that back... Mm. So I think, in a sense, there's a bit of settling going on, in a way, with things.
Would that be what you agree, Claire?
Yeah, I think so. I think the clients that we deal with at the moment in London are looking for you know, as you sort of say, the kind of glamour, but really working the spaces and looking for things that are genuine and the charm. I think charm is always something, you know, perhaps when you're working in chateaus in France, charm is something that's there in the history.
Yes.
It's very easy to lose charm, very hard to recreate charm. And as Adam says, when he's perhaps dealing with some projects and he's trying to, they've been butchered into these four-bedroom things and you're trying to sort of restore it to something that was there originally, I think that's sort of hard. But I think people are aware, you know, more perhaps now these days, they're not just sort of carving things up. I mean, sometimes you have to steer people, but... you know, we sometimes work with a developer and you're going, how do you make this a two-bedroom? It's going to be a much better... Forget about the fact that the estate agent's saying it's going to sell as a sort of much better as a four-bedroom. This is going to be a much, much better two-bedroom and, you know, that sort of thing.
Certainly when we look for projects to feature, charm or that sort of sense that somebody wants to be in that room and entertain friends around that table is sort of what the sparkle we're looking for. And it's hard to say there's a specific Homes and Gardens house. Because really, that's the spirit that you want to feel that the fire is on, or that people would read the paper. You know that, and finding that is difficult. Mm-hmm. And as you say, you know, it is hard to recreate once it's gone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, but very easy to lose. We're working on a project in Portugal where it's a ruin, and the building, the walls are so dilapidated, but they've got just the most wonderful patina and texture on them. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking, how can we rebuild these walls without sort of knocking them down, just keeping that and making sure that, you know, when the builders start to touch it, that they're not going to just sort of plaster and paint over and go, look, it's all sort of fixed, when you're sort of saying to them, actually, this is sort of what we love. Don't lose it. Hold on to that. And we have clients, for example, I sometimes say to them, look, buy a cheap pine floor, but it's the real material, as opposed to buying, say, a ceramic tile that's been printed to look like Carrara marble or something. Just, you know, go for the real thing sometimes, even if it's, you know, not the sort of highest spec of product in a way.
Yeah. Would you agree with that? In sort of when you're coming to a brief, are you trying to kind of educate people down that journey, or are people there already?
Not even sure I'm there already, but I think mostly, I think... I really like to use natural materials.
Mm.
I don't like to use things that are simulated something else, unless it's some sort of, you know, potentially clever trompe-l'oeil detailing or something like that. You know, one of the things when you're first starting to talk about rooms is talking, and this is where sort of to go back to colour, you know, is so interesting, is that at different times of day and at different times of the year, the room can look totally different. Mm. So I do often say to people, when you've painted something and it's dark and it's November and it's raining, to sort of stick with it for a while, you know, because I think things like that can make a massive difference to how it feels on a perky summer's morning.
And lighting. I think, you know, we all acknowledge how important lighting
also,
is, but also, you know, how difficult lighting is.
You so rarely get to see finished rooms that you've done in the evening. And see how the clients actually live there, so that's quite
that's
an interesting
thing.
What would be, sort of, Claire, what would be your advice on a lighting perspective? When
I usually have a base rule, which is don't put spotlights in living rooms or bedrooms.
Yeah, yes.
Put spotlights in, say, bathrooms, in utility
utilitarian space.
And when you do put spotlights, make sure that you get the kind of warmest Kelvin LED light bulb, because we sort of have to put those in and really control them. And sometimes pull them closer to the wall so that you get a scalloping of light rather than a, you know, that sort of... So you don't feel like you're sort of in a dentist. And then in living spaces, create lights where, you know, 5-amp circuits where there's lamps and where the lamps are at different levels.
Absolutely.
So you don't sort of have this kind of, you know, dark bit. You know, just control the lighting like that. And it's so important. I mean, you go to restaurants and you go, why is that restaurant empty? And I often go, well, it's the kind of halogen tubes they've got. What were they
who
thinking?
Who would want to go in there?
Who would want to go in there? Yes. Bring the lighting down. And you sort of... Now, sometimes I have to stop myself from going to the manager and go, you know, turn all the ceiling lights on, put candles on, then that might work.
Yeah.
And I think my rule of thumb is we put dimmers everywhere. I mean, even in closets. I mean, we just is have the ability to have switched lighting where you can and have... them all with lamps where you turn on one switch and all the lamps go on.
Yeah.
But even then, have that on dimmer, because I think it just makes such a difference to have that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sort of technology, neutral technology, and all these things these days to kind of, you know, arrive into a mood and go evening, kind of romantic setting. I always have a bit of a phobia with those guys. I love a on-off switch.
Absolutely. I find that 9 times out of 10 clients say, oh, I just wish I had never put the system in.
Yeah.
I mean, I shouldn't say this, but no. I mean, it becomes so complicated.
Yeah.
And again, some of the young tech clients, they're fine with it.
But the
average person does not really want to know how to manage all of that.
Yeah,
I suppose on the comfort piece as well, sort of where technology kind of sits with that, because, you know, comfortable rooms probably don't feel very high tech. There's something very lo-fi about a room that feels very comfortable.
Yeah, completely. We don't use we use technology for music and TV and that sort of thing because it's so great, but we don't generally do lighting systems unless they're teenagers.
Right.
Or at least in their early 20s, and they know how to manage it from the app, you know.
Then their phone runs out of battery and they've got no light. We're about at question time, so I don't know whether we can keep chatting, but if there's any questions, maybe we'll pause here, and if there aren't, we can continue on. Does anybody have any questions for the panel? No pressure.
Someone must have some questions.
Great.
Oh, good.
Thank you, Joanne.
You were talking about boldness, you know, trying to get your client to be bolder with color.
I didn't know if you had a particular technique or trick to encourage people to be bolder with color, whether it was a piece or a room, or how do you get a client to be bolder with color?
A full sense of security. I don't know. I mean, it can't work out of context of a whole scheme. So, you know, you can't suggest someone has a lacquered red dining room if there isn't a sort of narrative that ends up with that being your kind of big killer punch, you know? So you don't sort of sneak around the back and just sort of...
So is that a colour thread? Would you be, say, in this example, trying to have a red thread that's sort of traced from the front door, or are you thinking...
No, I think if I was going to do something super punchy like that, most of the house would be quite punchy.
Right.
And then it wouldn't be such a sort of terrifying thing.
Mm.
I mean, that's the way I would effectively sell it, for want of better
One of the things we do at the second meeting with a client, we actually show them all the colors, basically all colors, and actually walk through them and say, do you like reds? Do you like blues? Do you like, you know, all these different things? Because it helps then when you do present color, you already know that, they hate purple. So just purple comes off the table and it's never even a consideration for any of the presentations. So by doing that, we do things like that. We all do that for furniture style, for all different things. So we know up front what are their likes and their dislikes. So we'll do it with patterns. We'll say, do you like checks? Do you like plaids? And we actually show them all. And do you like paisleys? Do you like whatever? So that it's a way of editing what you're showing them later on, so you're more likely to get it right as you go forward.
And I try to avoid discussing color in the office with the clients, because you have to go to site. And the builders I work with, they go crazy, because I will have so many swatches, but not even just on one wall, but on every wall, because the light falling from that window on that is good. The colour's going to look completely different to the green this way, the green that way. And we now sort of, our colour swatches kind of just get bigger and bigger, and they're these big boards that we carry around. But also, I sometimes say to clients, look, colour is perhaps, it's not for free, but it's an easier thing to change. Perhaps not if you're sort of lacquering a red dining room, but if you do paint a room and you just go, I just cannot live with this, and I've done this in my own house. You can change it. It's not like you're going, I don't like my kitchen extension, I'm going to knock it down and rebuild it. So perhaps you don't want to change it if you've picked all your curtains and all your sort of soft furnishings and everything else around it. But, I think let them sort of try to be bold by sort of saying, perhaps, look, have a go and definitely test it on site, really, you know, carefully on all of the walls, not just one with a little sort of, right, you know, Dulux or Farm Ball or whatever it is, little sort of paper. It's just impossible.
Yeah,
to see.
And I would totally agree that it's so important that you always do colors on site. Because it's interesting. We were doing an airplane, and literally you go up, and believe it or not, colors totally change because of the light.
The light, yeah.
But it's true from one part of town to another part of town.
Yeah.
The light will be so different.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's so
we
important.
We did all the paint colors for a house. We did. Helen. we did a house in Scotland, and we did all the boards in London. And it's sort of a mad thing that when you go north, the light is completely different. Yeah. Everything looked terrible. Obviously, we didn't tell anybody that. and then we came back and did it all again in a hurry, and it looked fine. But it was a big learning curve for me, that.
Yes,
and when you were designing the paint, the two collections that you've done with Plain English Design,
yes,
talk us through that and how that kind of works with your experience.
Well, those were just four kitchen cabinets.
Uh-huh.
So we had... we just, you know, I use them a lot for kitchens. They're a great company, and I think we just wanted to do something where, in the first collection, where we were thinking a little bit more about mid-century colours and more naturalistic colours and moving away from white or black, which... and then the second collection was a lot more 19th century, backstairs, rather kind of severe... pinch lip colours, but they're great, and I'm very happy with them. You know, and they look good.
Good.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the panel? Yes, please.
We do our work down in Cornwall, and we have a lot of large, very modern new builds that we deal with huge amounts of glass. And the challenge is always to try and, you know, create some atmosphere. And often with architects, we're looking for very clean, modern, you know, quite bland spaces, actually. I just wondered if you had any experience of, you know, offering advice to designers when you're in that sort of position of your vision is slightly different from the architects, and also, you know, how do you, when you've got these gigantic, you know, you don't want to put these enormous draped curtains in, which look completely inappropriate, but in the same vein, although they're often used as summer houses, you want to be able to use them in the winter. You don't want to sit in a black box.
A coziness, sure.
You know, and I think that's, I find that such a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we did a 1960s sort of penthouse apartment in Notting Hill that had exactly that. When it was bought, someone had come with sort of red velvet wallpaper, and this had these big sort of panes of glass. It was a bit of an unusual building, but perhaps a little bit like what you're describing. And we had to strip it back, but not, the client didn't want just sort of white, kind of minimal sort of shadow gaps. And so I think what we did was sort of say, you still need to make a home homely, you still need the texture, but maybe it's not sort of floral curtains, maybe it's just a lovely, you know, linen, or, you know, to give a bit of depth. But also, I find that sometimes even panelling big contemporary spaces, but in contemporary ways, not with sort of profiled beadings, but sometimes just putting something on the wall that will just break up a bit, you know, a big white plasterboard wall, is quite hard to sort of animate, you know, unless they've got sort of tons of furniture, you know, like, Timothy, this is probably one of yours, but, you know, there's so much on the backdrop of the walls already, and the frieze and the architraves of the doors and all of that, you know, you've already got so much going for, which is probably what you're struggling with, is you've got this sort of empty palette. And I think another thing to do, perhaps, is you can keep the kind of white or contemporary, you know, maybe put something on the ceiling, put contemporary sort of panelling on the ceiling. I think ceilings are something people forget about, because there's nothing worse, in my opinion, than a big expanse of kind of white plasterboard ceiling.
Right.
But, you know, ceilings, floors, putting a bit of texture on there that can be sort of subtle sometimes, you know, grooved, sometimes done in quite cheap ways even. You know, you can get big panels of MDF and router it on the router, get some groove, you put some paint on it, and the slimmest bit of beading, you just suddenly get a bit of texture, and then the furniture. But I think it's controlling the look, but still, you know, being able to layer and put, I think, you know, maybe linen, softer kind of woods and things like that. It is hard, because, contemporary architecture by its nature is going to sort of be that, and less of less of the kind of molded things.
Well, it's interesting because you just, there was a couple of pictures back, there was some project we did which was in a brand new building in Chicago where it was just a white box, and we literally had to do just that. We actually added layers of built-in bookcases or simple things, like, again, adding MDF, just some molding, things like that actually added depth and interest, because it's going to clearly be a contemporary box, but it's adding those layers of detail that help make it a little different, make it feel a little more special.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be done in a classical way.
No,
sort of molding.
It doesn't at all.
I mean, sometimes it just, you know, a few really simple panels just sort of, you know, break up the wall and, you know, break the expanse of whatever it is, plasterboard thing. Yeah.
Well, so we have talked a lot about colour, but we haven't talked as much about texture and natural materials, which you said you love working with, but, you know, how you can add depth with beautiful texture while still being very modern, sort of an incredible floor or a... Do you know whether you have any advice on textures or...
Well, the other thing that's interesting is that I find that the French always say that the ceiling is the fifth wall, and it's what so many places are forgotten, particularly in contemporary buildings. And so I always find it interesting to do things with the ceiling that all of a sudden adds texture and depth to a room, and it can be very subtle, but it actually adds that layer of detail that you don't notice at first.
Yeah. And is that from sort of painting it the same color as the walls to wallpapering to exposing, you know, anything that you think is particularly impactful or...
Almost anything is better than just sort of plasterboard, I think.
Yes, yes. I mean, we've done sometimes just even just a very slight textured wallpaper that then gets painted over so that it adds that depth.
Do you need to be cautious in a low-ceilinged room, or are we talking these solutions mainly if you've got that nice proportion? Because if you've got a news house, is there a worry?
Sometimes, typically, for example, in London houses, you know, you'll have your floor joists, and then you sort of get floor stuck on the top and plasterboard stuck on the bottom. Sometimes, actually, it's a low ceiling, but if you expose the floor joist, so you get these kind of, sometimes they're not great floor joists, they're just sort of very rugged pine or whatever it is, but actually just sort of expose it, put your insulation between, push your plasterboard or your panel. You just suddenly, I mean, this is concrete that we're in here now, but it just suddenly gives a bit of texture or interest, and it's like a floor, you know, it's sort of like perhaps like good shoes. You've got to, you know, it's got to be sort of good, and then, you know, and then you can layer up. So having the good sort of text just as your backdrop are important.
Any other questions? We've got time for one more. Yeah, great.
I'm just interested to know how, when you're working on different locations, different parts of the country, how do you manage your trades people to make sure you achieve a consistent finish on every project?
It's the most difficult part of the job, I think. Whether it's in one town, one part of town, or the other part of town, or let alone a different city or country, and it really you have to have hands on the ground all the time. You have to just be following it all the time. We're doing projects all around the world, so we actually have on all projects we've got construction on, we have weekly Skype meetings. Or FaceTime meetings with the contractor, and literally we go around and with the phone look at a certain detail, and he'll say, "Well, how do you want us to handle this, or how do you want us to do that?" Because there's nothing that replaces really seeing it firsthand.
Yeah, I tend to. There are certain phases in the building work where I just want to be there every day, you know, just to check that things are going on. And, you know, I'm zooming back and forth across London quite often during the course of a day, checking things are getting done nicely. And, you know, it's really important.
I think it's probably, but that's probably whether you're working abroad, there's the added challenge, whether you're in different time zones. But if you're doing a project in London, when it gets to those crucial states, you have to be there every day. I mean, someone sort of said to me once, you know, assumption is the biggest probably mistake. You can never assume that they're going to either A, interpret what you're thinking, and just you sort of have to draw, specify, and just be on site. You know, you have to go to site every day, because you'll arrive and you'll be like, well, wasn't it obvious? And it's like, well, it kind of was to us, but obviously if it's not either literally drawn or written, or, you know, so you just have to, really yeah. control those last bits and really...
And would you say that's at the end, or is that sort of, is there a sort of two-thirds of the way through, there's a bit of a...
I think it's far less, the mistakes you make at the end are far less easy to forgive.
So, yes. It can also be right at the beginning if you're working in an old or a period building yeah. where people are trying to strip things out.
Oh, yes, like, yeah.
Yes. No!
Yeah. I mean, in construction, if you put the steel beams in the wrong place, that's obviously a big mistake. You're sort of less likely to do that. Yeah. But, you know, on your sort of tiling, if you kind of go, well, it's obvious the kind of tap should have been in the middle of the tile. What were you thinking? Mm. It's like, well, you know, your drawing didn't sort of show the grout right. joint, you know, that sort of thing.
But, you know, the way we've gotten around that is we've actually done full-scale, for example, tile design. If we know that this is... We'll do full-scale, and we give it to the builder and sort of say... This is exactly what to follow, you know, down to the centimeter. So
Yeah.
And I suppose when you're working internationally, that is the only way because, well, Timothy was saying he does 1 week in Paris, 1 week in LA, and 2 weeks on the road, but that's a challenging.
but you have to stay on top of every project, regardless of whether it's in your backyard or in another city.
You know, working in Morocco, I've quite happy to allow a bit of local interpretation. Within reason.
Well, yeah. Adam was telling us how you design a collection of carpets or tiles, and you come back 6 weeks later, and the sort of the gap between what you possibly thought you've briefed in and what
it's called the ego gap. It's like how far do you want to push your own? Well, I mean, obviously you want it to look good, and you want it to look like you have put some thought to it, and you want the client to be happy. But a lot of the time, people, if you're using small local workshops. Kind of do it how they want to do it. Mm. And I think that often that can be a good thing rather than sort of imposing something that's not generic, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I thought we might have time for one more, but we don't. So thank you so much for your questions, and also thank you to the panel.
Thank
it's
you.
Been really
thank
interesting.
You.
Thank
you.
A lot of note-taking. There's obviously challenges and benefits on working on international projects, but there does seem to be also some common ground. Timothy, I can't quite believe that you oversee every project personally. God, you're like Superman, especially as detail seems to be so key to everything you do. Interestingly, you said that detailing was the ultimate luxury, and it's that subtlety, that layer on layer, that really communicates glamour. Now, Claire, you spoke about how great interiors, whether in the UK or the US, should bring joy. What a lovely word about interior design. And they should make you feel great. I love that. And Adam, you spoke about soulfulness and how art and antiques bring personality and individuality to any scheme. There was so much to talk about. I sort of feel we could be here for another couple of hours. In the meantime, because this is our opening conversation design session, I do hope you'll stay on and have a glass of fizz with us. And in the meantime, please join me in saying a very big thank you to our wonderful session and our wonderful panelists.